It might have been me putting myself back on mute.
Okay. So we spent 6 weeks at the first like half of the unit we've been learning, focusing on how the Torah interacts with other governments, right? And other systems of government, Dina de Malchusa Dina and the laws of Arkaos. And then we spent a couple of weeks on the Israeli court system. And that was a real transition because the second half of our unit is going to focus on Torah government, right? Like if you have a Jewish country, what does the Torah want government to look like? We'll talk about monarchy. We'll talk about democracy. We'll talk about the Sanhedrin. So this week is going to be kind of an introductory week. And we're going to talk about the concept of Malchus, of a very important Drashas Haran, and different systems of law that are simultaneously recognized by the halacha and how those, some very interesting ways that those interact. We're going to talk about an important book by the Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. It's Eliezer. But just by way of introduction before we talk about it, there's a fascinating shiur on Yayi Torah. I'm going to try to put this into the chat also, because it's really worth listening to at some point. It's long, but it's really worth listening. It's a talk that Rav Lechantin Zatzal gave in 1968. Yom HaTzma'ut 1968 in the YU Beis Medrash, I'm pretty sure. So, right, that's 1 year after the 1967 war. A lot of what he says is incredibly prescient when he analyzes the upsides and downsides of what victory in the Six-Day War would do for Eretz Yisrael spiritually. But a really, really important point he makes there, and he has a whole drasha about Sarah, who's 120 and 7, right? And the idea of 20 being the age where you reach a certain maturity. And so he talked about, you know, the advantages and disadvantages of as Medinat Yisrael leaves its real youth behind and matures into a more established country, how to look at that through a spiritual lens. And the advantages of it are obvious, right? Eretz Yisrael already had fought through three very serious wars. The country is becoming more secure, more established. Its existence is becoming more and more undeniable. The advantages are obvious. But at the same time, he talks about how a certain excitement, a novelty, and a romanticism fades as the reality of Eretz Yisrael becomes something we become more and more used to. So he talks, I forget who he quotes, who described in Europe how a Jew would come to visit their shtetl in, you know, the Russian Empire from having been to Yerushalayim, and talks about how, you know, the kids would come running out to touch his clothes because a Yerushalayim Yid came, and you could, you know, feel the connection to Yerushalayim and how that thrilled people, right? Just to have the most remote contact with Yerushalayim, and Eretz Yisrael kept us going for hundreds and hundreds of years, right? 20 years go by, Kal Vachomer, where we stand now, and so much of that is just something that we completely take for granted, don't we? You know, I mean, maybe pre-COVID, whoever you want to, you can jump on an airplane and fly over to Eretz Yisrael, right? The connection to the land, we're so connected to it that we almost take that connection for granted. So when we think about what a Torah country should look like, it's going to be so important for the next few weeks of learning to try to put ourselves in the shoes, right? Think about answering this question at the beginning of Hakamat Hamdina, right? Before the country was founded, because some of the attitudes I think that we're going to see then are attitudes that we will really, want to instill in our own experience as we learn these together. Okay, so with like that as like a hashkafic background. So the major work that we're going to refer to a lot, it's a fascinating book. Got it right here, right? Hilchos Medina, Agon Baal Hatzitz Eliezer. Hatzitz Eliezer, Eliezer Waldenberg, born in 1915 in Yerushalayim. More well known for his medical halacha, Psakim, right? I think he has like 22 volumes of Shalei Tshuvot. was a Rav right next to Shari Tzedek Hospital in Yerushalayim. So organically, you know, doctors were davening in his minyan. So he begins getting medical questions and he's able to answer them. So he gets, you know, more and more and more. Long time on the Bezin HaGadol in Yerushalayim. Talmud of Rav Yisro Zalman Meltzer. So in 1952, he published the first volume of this book, Hilchos Medina, The Laws of a Country. And we're gonna take a look at his Hakdama, because it's a fascinating introduction. It's a hashkafa that I don't think we really see very much of nowadays, and one which is really helpful for A, understanding some of what we're gonna see him do in the coming weeks, and B, just a perspective for us to keep in mind. Now, something interesting with the history of the book. I came to Israel to learn in 2007. So there have been like rumors about this book. It was very hard to find. I dug up a copy. You see on the title page, it says something very interesting. Right? It says here, it was published here in Yerushalayim, Eir Kodesh, in Tafshin Samach Zayin, December 2006. B'malot Shloshim Yom Liftirato, right? 30 days after he passed away. So that's interesting. So that's 2006. And you turn the page and you get to the original title page. The original title page, you can see the year that it was published was Tafshin Bet Yud. So that's 1952. So you get to ask, right, why is it published in 1952? For whatever reason, it was not published again until the very end of 2006, almost 2007. Right after he passed away. And after he passes away, and when this is published, there's a huge uproar because his descendants claim that they did not want it published and they fought very hard to get it taken off of the market. There are two theories as to why they wanted that to happen. One theory, I think the more mainstream theory, is that his grandchildren did not appreciate the more Zionistic tinge in the book. The other theory, apparently, that I saw in an article, claims that they secretly published the book and they tried to get it taken off the market to stir up controversy, to get people excited about it. Not sure how likely that is, but that's the conspiracy theory. You know, you go on the message boards and you'll find that version on there. Be that as it may. So it's his book. He writes in 1952. So that's what, 4 years after he's in his 30s, a young man, but you know, not surprisingly, brings a massive amount of material and very interesting contribution. I've only read like a few small parts of it. He has a haskama from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who says, "I got this book before Shabbos. You know, I spent all of Shabbos reading it. It was great. Made my Shabbos. You know, amazing book." Okay. So that's the sefer. The attitude in 1952, right, in all sorts of ways, is not the same as the attitude in 2006, but it's a young country. And see, like, the attitude that that he has. So let me load up this screen share, and we'll get some of, just look at like a piece of it. Right, so here we go. Tzitz Eliezer, right, here's the title page. Very good. Right, 1952. And what do you see on the title? B'siyo Mosader Kuk Sha'al Yad Mizrahi Holami. Right, so that's fine. So it's such an interesting hakdama. But the beginning of it, so he says, right, Davar Shalach Hashem, I can't see, B'Yakob B'Nafal B'Yisrael. Right, so the first thing is, you know, this is a brand new country. It's 4 years old. And this comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Gavru Alinu Chasdei Hashem. So that's step number one, right? Opening sentence of the Hakdama is, we, right, the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us an independent country, right? And he says, look, we're still missing a bunch. We're still missing, major parts of the land. Remember, he's writing this in 1952. We're still missing the base of Mikdash, obviously, which is still true. But off the bat, this is Tzitz Eliezer writing. We have to recognize the fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us something absolutely incredible. Okay, that's one thing to take up before we get here. And one reason why, we can imagine that this, his descendants may not have been so happy having this republished. Now, at the same time that he has this going on, right? He says, if you read it carefully, he doesn't think of anything going forward as guaranteed. There's no language in his Hakdama of words like Atchata de Geula, beginning of the redemption, right? It's not, the Mashiach is on its way and there's nothing that can stop it. It says, Hashem gave us an unbelievable gift. And the question is, what are we going to do in response? When Hashem did something for us, we have to do something in return. Chashmonaim, were given the victory over the Greeks. First thing they do is they run to Yerushalayim to purify the Beis HaMikdash. We've been given a country. What is the first way we have to respond? So he says the answer is, this is kind of interesting, see where this comes from. I don't know, like, what would you think? Well, you're given a country. What's the first religious response that we have an independent country? What do you think would be the first response to put there?
Some way of thanking Hashem.
Okay.
How? I don't know.
Well, Hal v'Hoda, right? So we could have like a Yom HaAtzmaut conversation maybe. Right? So he says, and he thinks of this kind of messianically, that, we have to try to fulfill our ultimate destiny. And that ultimate destiny is having Mishpat in the heart of Eretz Yisrael, right? That's what the focus of the project is going to be. How do we have what we would call a Torah just society? That is our ultimate destiny, and that's what we have to try to pursue. Now, where does this come from? So one of the interesting things about this Hakdama, usually you open up a Hakdama to a Sefer, and what are you going to find? You're going to find quotes of Gemaras and Rishonim, Achronim. He quotes one Gemara, but almost the entire thing is quoting Psukim from Navi, and specifically quoting Psukim from Yeshayahu. And it happens to be, Pasuk he quotes is a Pasuk which pretty clearly, shows he's right. He quotes, what does Yeshayahu describe as the Messianic era? Well, everyone's going to come to the Har Hashem. Why? He's going to teach us his ways. We'll go in his ways. So if we're given Eretz Yisrael, our ultimate destiny is to be the place where everyone comes for justice. So he says that is the Messianic era, right? It's so interesting. He doesn't focus on establishing national sovereignty per se, military elements, sovereignty, liberty. He says we've been given a country, and now our job to respond, if we want to advance the project. He never says the word Mashiach. He never says Eschalta de Geula, but it's like under the surface. He has it there, under the surface. If we want to fulfill our ultimate destiny, we need to focus on a society of Mishpat. If you remember the last shiur we had on these topics before Hanukkah a couple of weeks ago, we learned from Rav Herzog. And there was that essay where Rav Herzog said, here are the main issues we have as we found a new country. And for the most part, there are ones which we still think about today. And we think about religion and civil society in Israel. It was gittin, it was kashrus. But one that he had that was a little bit surprising was civil law, was mishpat, which Herzog thought was absolutely essential in the founding of a country. What is the interplay? What's the relationship between halacha and the government going to be? And the Tzitz Eliezer has this as well. And he says, unfortunately, we're very far from where we need to be on that front. There's a long way to go in making our society more just than it is. And so he says, Kano Kanesi, I've become, exceedingly zealous, and I've worked very hard, and I've written this sefer. It's a monumental work. So
that is, you know, I don't know what you would call that, hashkafa. Like it's not dati lumi, but it's not Haredi, right? And it's not, I don't think it's really one that really exists very much now, but it's someone who totally steeped in Torah and is reacting from a religious perspective to the new reality of a Medina. It came from Hashem. How are we supposed to respond? And his default response is, we have to think about how to have as much Torah Mishpat in the government and in society as possible. So that's his task. And we're going to look at some of his contributions tonight and in coming weeks. Okay.
Can I just mention something?
Yeah. Sure.
Just mention, Tehillim Kuch HaFeiz.
Okay.
Where are we going to find when we come to Shulayim? Kishama Yashu, Kisof Lumishpat, Shalushlom Yushalayim, Yishlo Yuai Ohabaya, Yishlom Dokhele Shavavam Messiah. So when do you have Shalom? When you have Mishpat. And Yushalayim is supposed to be the place where you have the Mishpat.
Thank you.
Yeah.
There you go. Awesome.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, I'll just show one more thing from him. I want to show how he concluded his, how does he conclude his Hakdama? Right, more psukim, and then he says, "B'schut shmirat chukei Hashem be'olam hazeh nizkav v'nechiyav v'nirael v'nirash hatorah v'rachal shnei mod Mashiach chukei olam haba." Right, so that closing sentence, right? He is not, you know, this is not someone who's saying it's okay that a lot of society is chiloni. You know, we have redemption. People go to the army. Everything is just, you know, moving inexorably towards Geula. That's not the perspective that you get here, right? This would not be the sentence you would get in like a standard Dati Lumi close of an introduction, right? He's saying we need to spread Torah and mitzvos. At the same time, right? You know, he's looking at society and seeing, you know, he wants more mitzvah observance than there is. Same time, you know, like very, very subtly and hinting, right? If this happens, maybe we can find ourselves in the Messianic era. So he's not, I don't think he is, you know, getting up in shul and saying, you know, Reishis Tzmichas Gulasenu, right? He'd maybe be a Shetehei, Reishis Tzmichas Gulasenu. Maybe he'd be more of the hopeful. So just a really interesting perspective. And I don't think it's one that you find so much of now, but like very, very clear where he was coming from. I think important to have that in mind, right? And the newness of the country, as we learn this, you know, we try to bring ourselves back, you know, and imagine reacting to the country as a fresh reality. Okay, so the one reason why I chose the topic just for tonight is because it's gonna transition really well from I think what we did the last few weeks. I think a major idea that we took away from the learning we did before was that it's not really this tension, but there's an interplay when we talk about Sanhedrin and we talk about Mishpat and government, that the halacha recognizes that law operates on two different planes, right? There's the plane of Torah halacha, divine law, which is obviously sacrosanct and takes precedence over all. But again and again, we saw that the halacha recognizes in some form or fashion, the reality and certain space for a human law system. And that was so much of the back and forth was figuring out where that space is, what that space is. You know, on the one hand, when people are going to the secular courts, when they're supposed to go to the Beis Din, so it doesn't get any worse than that, right? That's going to our coast. That's choosing the human over the divine, and that's complete chil Hashem. The Rashba says that's avodah zarah, because ultimately, right, choosing man over God is avodah zarah. But at the same time, you know, sometimes things are more complicated. So for example, or just a few examples, Rashi seemed to say that was the whole ideological basis for mitzvahs b'nei Noach. Where did b'nei Noach get the idea of dinin from, right? That they have to set up a certain civil law. So that it sounded like, according to Rashi, the mitzvah for B'nai Noah was to set up a system which is not being based on Sinai, right? The Goyim rejected the Torah when they had the chance. But it's based on their intuition of what man finds fair and just, and that has a certain recognition. The Rashbam seemed to say that was ultimately what was powering Dina de Malchus Adina. And the Rashbam said that the people, recognize the power of the government, but what gives the government power? Again, it seemed to be mitzvahs dinin given to Bnei Noach, which is built upon man's ethical creation, right? Which again is incomparable to Torah law, but it exists, right? And there's a space for it. The two other places where we saw that was the Klei Chamda's explanation of why is it when Jews are not able to go to a Beis Din, right? The Beis Din, is not in a place where it's going to be able to enforce its judgments. So what is it, what are you supposed to do? So in such a case, Shulchan Aruch says, that is when, they write a permission slip for you and you go to the local Beis Din. You go to the local non-Jewish court. And the Klei Chamda's theory was that it was never prohibited to go to an alternative court when you were not going to be able to get justice in the Beis Din. But what's operating behind that is, there's ideal lechachila, very, very lechachila justice coming from the Beis Din. But if that's not available, says the Klei Chamda, then you go to the human level. And finally, that seemed to be the whole strange Gemara about the Arkos of Surya, right? Those courts where, they're not in Eretz Yisrael, they're not in Bavel, they're using some local magistrates or people off the street who, as the Rishonim described, they have some Seichel HaYashar and they're fine, upright, people, but they're Amoratzim, right? Said the Rashba. So what seemed to be going on over there? Same phenomenon. Right, that if you don't have recourse to the system that we want, so we have to have recourse to the other system that we have. So it exists, this other system, and there are certain spaces for it, recognizing the legitimacy and morality and ethics of a man-made legal system, even as at the same time, Alach is driving home time and time and time again, that when you elevate that to replace the halacha, so that's as great a chil Hashem as they come, because you're taking something that's good, and man is can accomplish good things, we're using that ultimately to replace a Kadosh Baruch. So that's this very, very important to recognize that they both exist, but also where they have their place. So that dynamic sets up an absolutely essential chiddush from the Ran. Right, Rabbeinu Nisim, one of the major Rishonim, which becomes foundational for any subsequent discussion about these topics. Refers to the Drashos HaRan. When you just say the Drashos HaRan, so there are a bunch of them, long and they're hard. But if you talk about the Drashos HaRan, so everyone assumes, oh, you're talking about Drasha Yud Aleph, and really the beginning of Drasha Yud Aleph, which is on Parsha Shoftim, where he talks about the interplay between these two systems. But he talks about it as far as the relationship between not, halacha and Bnei Noach, the halacha and Arkos Shebesuria. The Ran talks about it in two halachically recognized judicial systems. And how do they interact with each other? One is the Sanhedrin, Moshe and Yisro at the beginning. So the Sanhedrin sitting in Yerushalayim, and they're overseeing all of the other Batei Din. That's classic, Jewish government. What's the other system? The Melech. This past week's Haftorah was Shlomo, right? For the first time in 20 years, we have the Haftorah of Shlomo. So we know that the king is engaged in judgment. Shlomo doesn't seem to be the Av Beis Din, right? Shlomo is not sitting in the Sanhedrin. So what is the place of justice coming from the Sanhedrin, and what is the role of justice coming from the king? What are these two institutions? How do they interact with each other? That is what the Ran takes up. So we'll look at some of that. And then if we have time, we'll look at a couple of interesting pieces that helpless Medina and the Tzitz Eliezer brings in to help sharpen what he develops. Okay, so let's load up the screen share again. So just by way of background to kind of set it up. So you have in source number four over here in the Rambam, and this is one of three examples could have chosen. The Rambam shows that the king has certain judicial prerogatives, and they seem pretty drastic. So the Rambam is talking in Halchos Melachim, which is where, he talks about the laws of a melech, naturally. So he talks in Halacha Ches over here. We'll not focus on this tonight. I would like to get back to this in a week or two because it's interesting. He talks about the rule of Mori B'malchus, right? Someone rebels against the king, the king's allowed to kill him. Now, which is kind of surprising. Like, why is that true? So maybe we'll come back to that, but not this week. Lach Yud, the Rambam says, Kol ha-horig nefashas below raya bure, anyone who murders someone without a clear proof, o below hasra, without a warning, afilu ve'ed achad, or there's one witness, o sonu shaharig b'shgaga, right? It seems like it was an accident, but we know that the murderer hates the victim's guts, so it's likely that it was, a staged accident, writes the Rambam, yesh lamelech reshus lahargo, the king has permission to execute him. Ulsakin ha'olam, right, to try to fix the world. I don't think this is what people usually have in mind when they talk about tikkun olam, but that's how the Rambam over here uses it. Kefi ma shehasha'a tzricha, right, in accordance with whatever he thinks the hour needs. And the Rambam continues. If he thinks he needs, if the king thinks he needs to kill people, he can do that. A Bezdin can only do one Dina Nefashos case a day, but the king, if he wants, can do more in order to intimidate Rishayim, says the Rambam. Okay? So that's kind of piece number one. We see that a Melech is able to do certain things, right, when it comes to executing justice that it seems like a Bezdin cannot do. And just to highlight the distinction, so let's look at two lines of Gemara, which show how almost impossible it is in normal circumstances to get a conviction for a capital crime in a Bezdin. So Gemara says in source number five, and I see I didn't remember the next thing. Gemara says in source number five, Tana Rabbanan, right? You have a Braisa. So when we cross-examine the Edim in a murder case. So how does the Bezdin cross-examine the Edim? So Makira Matemo so, right? So do you recognize the guy? That's step number one. Okay, that's reasonable enough. Nachri harag, Yisrael harag. Okay, right? Did he kill? Did he murder a Gentile or a Jew? Again, so we start off with the softball questions. We expect the Edom to be able to answer those. Then it's gonna get harder and harder as we go. Hisri simbo, did you warn him before he committed the murder? Kibel alav hasra. It's not enough to merely warn the criminal. The criminal has to accept the hasra. Right? He has to acknowledge that he heard what you said. Hitir atzmo lemisa. Not only does the murderer have to say, I heard your warning and I am doing it anyway, meaning I know it's forbidden and yet I'm going to shoot him. He has to be matir atzmo lemisa. He has to say, I know that it's prohibited to kill and that it is a capital crime and I'm going to kill him anyway. How often does that happen, right? Now, the Edim are there on the premises. They're telling the murderer what are the consequences of his crime. He says, he doesn't just ignore them, right? He answers, I hear you. I know it's prohibited. I know it's prohibited under capital punishment, and yet I'm going to do it. And not only that, but the Bryce says there's one more condition, because not only does the murderer have to acknowledge the warning and acknowledge the punishment, but himis besoch kedei dibur says, did the murderer commit the murder within Toch Kedei Dibur, right? Within the time it takes to say hello when the warning was given. Because otherwise, who knows? He may have forgotten the warning, right? So just reconstruct. In order to get a criminal conviction, in order for the Bezdin to execute someone for murder, what do we need? We need Edim, two witnesses, two kosher witnesses on hand. They have to give a warning. The guy has to acknowledge the warning, acknowledge the punishment, and then immediately kill the guy anyway, right? How often does that ever happen? It's like, it's almost impossible. So on the one hand, you have the king,
who the Rambam said, basically, he can execute murderers just based on what he thinks the hour requires. It doesn't need to be a clear proof, doesn't need to be a warning, you don't need two witnesses, it doesn't even have to be bemazed, right, if it looks like it was a show gig, but come on, you know, everyone knows that the guy hated his guts, so what looked like a show gig was obviously mazed. All those cases, the king can just say, I'm abandoning technicalities, and we're doing what needs to be done, l'sakin ha'olam. And in contrast, when the Beis Din is trying these cases, they are incredibly limited. So that's the frame to appreciate what the Ran is going to do. So the Ran, right, the 11th drasha of the Ran. So it's on Parsha Shoftim, and it's on what seems to be an innocuous pasuk, right? It's a pasuk that might be familiar. Shoftim, Shotrim, you hear the trumpet back your head from, you know, the beginning of the Parsha. Titen lecha b'chol sharecha, right? So you have judges and officers and all your gates, asher Hashem lokach nosin lecha, that Hashem has given you, l'shvatecha. Okay, that's a word. What is it for your tribes? That sets off the whole thing. And the pasuk ends, v'shaftu asa'am mishpat tzedek. Okay, right? They should judge the people with, you know, how are we going to call it? Just law, let's say, mishpat tzedek. Oh, okay, fine. Right, seems pretty innocuous. You should have judges, and they should judge the people justly. Now, Rashi comments on this pasuk. That's the part that I cut out here. Rashi comments on this pasuk that what it means, v'shaftu asa'am mishpat tzedek, means that the judges should be upright people. The judges should be tzaddikim who are capable of dispensing mishpat tzedek. So what's the old methodological question, right? What is bothering Rashi? Why did Rashi have to comment on the pasuk? The pasuk seems completely straightforward. Yeah, Torah says, make judges, and they should judge the people with mishpat tzedek. So why does Rashi have to jump in and say, what it means is not that they should dispense justice, it means they should be people who are capable of dispensing justice. Why does Rashi have to even say that? So the reason is very simple. The next pasuk, right after this one, says, Lo satem mishpat. Judges are not allowed to render a crooked judgment. So if you read the pasuk like pshat, you have a redundancy. Shavtu asam mishpat tzedek. Judge them justly. Lo satem mishpat. Do not twist the judgment. I don't need, right? If he's the only one, then I know the other. You don't have to tell me, judge justly and also don't twist judgment. So that's what Rashi says. Okay, the first half is talking about the judges should be people who can give justice, and the second pasuk is saying they have to give justice. But the Ran, that's like the Ran's jumping off point, because he doesn't really like, you know, he understands Rashi's problem. There is a redundancy in the Chumash. The Chumash seems to say twice, you have to back to back, you have to have judges who are doing mishpat tzedek. So the Ran goes off on whole explanation. He says, you have to understand there's something completely different going on here. This line of mishpat tzedek means something else entirely. It does not just mean justice, righteousness. Is a very, very important term, mishpat tzedek. What is going on? So the Ran goes on to say, he says, look, why do we have a government? Right? We have a Sanhedrin. Why do we have judges? Why do we have a government? For two reasons. One, very simple. We need judges because, you know, the Mishnah Perkei Avos, Ish es re'eu chayim b'la'o, man would eat his fellow alive. We need to have a judicial system and a government, when he says Yishuv Medini, because that's just how human society works. Human society, right? Man has, you know, corrupt tendencies, and we have to have judicial enforcement to keep society functioning. And he says, you know, B'nai Yisrael need that just like all other nations, right? B'nai Noach, that's the mitzvah of Dinin. That's one of the seven mitzvahs of B'nai Noach, is to have a judicial system. So, okay, we need it for the same reason, no question. And then he says, of course, you know, a Jewish Beis Din does not only enforce, murder and torts, etc. Beis Din is involved in all sorts of things, right? Beis Din is involved in Hilchos Shabbos. So he says, you need the Beis Din for something else. But who, l'hamid chukei HaTorah al-talem, right? Beis Din is also responsible for
for instilling Torah in the community. And he says that the whole point of Torah justice is to create a society which is not only built on security and material stability, but also a society that is built on Torah law, which ultimately, why ultimately do you want to have a society that's built on Torah? You want to have a society, right, which has the Shechina at the heart of it. Since that's why the Sanhedrin, right, where does the Sanhedrin HaGadol have to set up shop? They do not just have some very impressive building anywhere in Yerushalayim. The halacha is the Sanhedrin has to sit in the Lishkas HaGazis, right, the chamber of hewn stone, which is right on the border, half and half. If you open, the Kati Maseches Amidos and get the Beis HaMikdash map, you'll see it's half and half on the border between the Beis HaMikdash and outside the Beis HaMikdash. Because the whole idea of the Sanhedrin is trying to bring the Shechina, to bring Torah into the world, right? And so that's why you have the Beis Din in the Beis HaMikdash, but also half outside the Beis HaMikdash, because we're trying to bring that out there. It's a much more aspirational system than just dry peace and security. But he says those are the two systems. He says the Shoftim are all about pure Torah law, ideal Torah law. That's the Shoftim, that's the Sanhedrin. And he says that is that term, that funny term in the Chumash, right? Of Vishavtu Asa'am Mishpat Tzedek. Mishpat Tzedek doesn't just mean justice. It means pure ideal justice. It means the justice of Torah, right? But if you think about the Sanhedrin, which is trying to run a society where they cannot convict a murderer unless you've got a warning and an acceptance of the warning, and he says, I accept that it's a capital crime, et cetera, et cetera, that can lead to a society where murderers are just running rampant, right? On the one hand, this is an exceptionally aspirational society. We are never going to convict someone falsely, right? If someone's getting convicted of a capital crime by Beis Din, 100% that he is guilty. Nobody being falsely accused, but Beis Din is not going to execute someone who doesn't deserve it. God forbid. On the other hand, right, what's the inevitable downside of that is people, the deterrence factor isn't there, right? You could have a draconian system which could reduce murder, right? You have a more stable society, but the cost of it is untold of numbers of people who are being convicted falsely. That's the trade-off. So says the Ran that trade-off, it's not to be shied away from. He says that is exactly why the Torah sets up two different systems. And what is the compensation for the fact that trying to have a society based purely on Torah law and a Sanhedrin will not always, keep stability in a society because man is fallen? Because the answer is, "Mimnei shehasidur hamedini lo yishalem bazeh levado." Since you will not necessarily have a well-organized polity with just the system alone, Hishlim ha'el tikuno b'mitzvas ha'melech. Ribono shel Olam completed this, right? We supplement the Sanhedrin with mitzvas ha'melech, with the prerogative of the king. And the king has much more flexibility because ultimately the melech and the Sanhedrin are trying to accomplish two different things, right? The Sanhedrin's justice is there to instill Torah and the Shechina in Klal Yisrael. And the Melech is all about preserving the peace and stability. So you have those two systems that are operating simultaneously. There's a reason why the Melech is right next to the Sanhedrin. They're probably Shlomo and the Sanhedrin are probably talking to each other all the time. But they have two different but complementary goals. Right, and he goes on to explain, the innocent people getting off for murder is the great example of the trade-off, right? So there's no question for Mishpat Tzedek, Lama Yumasiyishim Lo Sheyeda Shechnis Atzma B'Davar Shishvachiyav Misa. Sanhedrin's not going to punish someone
unless we know for sure that he is guilty, right? But that has consequences, and that's what the Melech is there for. The Melech is there to determine, as the Rambam said, if Lasak in the Olam, right, in a world where Kali Yisrael are being good, right? Baruch Hashem, crime is very low. So then we can have the ideal system, right? The Sanhedrin and et cetera. When Kali Yisrael, right, as the Gemara says, Nefishi Rachtsanim, murder is on the way up. So then we need to downgrade. We need to go to this system instead. Says the Ran, by the way, says this is exactly, right, the answer to the question everyone asks, which is why did, what was the sin of Kali Yisrael with Shlomo, with Shmuel, right? People say they want a king. So says the Ran, very, very simple. Right? After all, Torah says, right, Torah talks about when you establish a king. So the Ran says, I'll tell you the problem. Kali Yisrael, right, could have wanted a system that was exclusively, right, they wanted total prioritization of stability and security with none of the aspirational element whatsoever, right? Said life under a system where we try to have the Ribbono Shel Olam in our midst is too difficult. We're not interested. All we want is give us a king like everyone else, right? Keep crime low. That's the number one priority. Says Shmuel HaNavi, I understand you want to keep crime low, but you want to have, you know, Ribbono Shel Olam in your midst. That's not a goal at all. You're okay with, you know, whatever draconian measures a king takes. You know, he says, you know, the ends justify the means. That's the attitude you're going to have, right? Shmuel HaNavi, not interested. Hashem's not happy either. But says the Ran, that's exactly the trade-off. He says one other thing is very interesting. He says that's why the king specifically, that's why the king has to carry a Sefer Torah. Why does a king carry a Sefer Torah, but the Sanhedrin doesn't? Right, if the Torah is just there, it's like, you know, you keep like your pocket Shulchan Aruch available. So why does only the king have to carry a Torah with him? So says the Ran, it's very simple. Because since the king is using his own sense of justice, right, and he's bypassing the Torah, you know, yes and no, the Torah is allowing him to bypass it in the interests of furthering stability over other goals. So to compensate, says the Ran, is specifically the king who needs to carry the Torah with him all the time, right? Because, you know, if he's the one who's going to be instituting emergency measures, he has to constantly be aware of what he is overriding with those emergency measures that he has to instill. So the Ran says this idea explains his pasuk in Shoftim. This is the relationship between the king and the Sanhedrin, two different goals, right? Two pieces to close that the Tzitz Eliezer brings, right? We think about the relationship between these two. So Tzitz Eliezer quotes some very interesting thoughts from the Klei Chamda. We'll quote these and then we'll close. Klei Chamda says, first of all, what is the scope of the king's ability to, obviously, you know, so much more going on, but this is, I think, good for tonight. It says, what is the scope of the king's ability to try cases? And what is it ultimately based on? Right, the king certainly cannot just say whatever he wants. You know, his law goes. And there are plenty of Gemaras about David and Shlomo and Yoshio who were involved in judging. So Klei Chamda says, very simple, this whole system that the Ran talks about of the tikkun medini, keeping peace in society, is only relevant to the world of mitzvos b'nei noach. Talk about geza, talk about theft, talk about murder. So there the king has a seat at the table, right? We have a Hilchos Shabbos campaign. The king is not instituting, you know, anyone who's under suspicion of violating Shabbos, right? The king is coming after you with his more flexible system. That is not his lane. Because, right, to Klei Chamda, those are mitzvos which are purely about instilling HaKadosh Baruch Hu in society. And that means that those are only relevant to the Sanhedrin. It is mitzvos which are both, right? Bein Adam L'Chaveiro and Bein Adam L'Makom. That is the world of Dini Mamonos and Dini Nefashos, of murder and of theft, etc., where if there's a second Torah-recognized system, as we've seen before, right, the system of Bein Noach, that is where the king has his alternative avenue that he can use when necessary. And one really interesting idea, and with this we'll close. Yeah, I'll show this one. It's very cool.
So there's a Kli Chemda in Shmos. So
he has the following thought.
You know, the halacha is, if you appoint, you can appoint a shliach to do many things for you, right? You can have an agent who does things for you. But the Gemara says, you can't have a shliach advar avera.
You cannot have someone be your agent, you know, for doing a sin. And then, you know, it counts as being done by you, right? So if I ask someone to steal from me, you know, I am not blamed for the theft, because you should have, the other person should have known better, right? The Gemara says, Divrei HaRav, Divrei HaTalmid Mishomim, right? Hashem said, don't steal. Shmerel said, steal. Why listen to Hashem instead of Shmerel? What's going on? So the halacha is, though, when it comes to non-Jews, that's not the case. Because when it comes to Gayim, we do say the Shleach HaVar Aver. We do blame non-Jews if they send someone. So Kli Chemda says, when it comes to a king, the so-called, he says, a king who is using the Ben Noach system, right? So that creates, and on the one hand, right, he's been giving a lot more liberty. On the other hand, that means that he has to hold himself to the stringencies of that standard, right? It says, Tzarech Lios Naki Vitzadik Af Bedine Ben Noach. So what does that explain? What is the case that we can talk about a king who is called out for being a for using the idea of Shliach Lidvar Avera? So this explains what Nasan Hanavi tells David HaMelech in the aftermath of the sin of Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah, right? And what's the line that Nasan says to David? He says, concerning Uriah, Oso haragta b'chayr b'nei Amon. You killed Uriah with the sword of b'nei Amon. Now, anybody who's learning Masechet Kiddushin is going to ask, oh, wait a second, right? There's a stira between the Pasuk and the Gemara and Kiddushin, right? What do you mean, Oso haragta b'chayr b'nei Amon? David can't kill b'chayr b'nei Amon because David is the Mishaleach, right? He sent Yoav to have the army attack and have Amon kill him. It doesn't make any sense, right? So Kli Chemda says this is exactly the answer. When the king, right, the whole idea that the Ran has set up, that the Torah recognizes that the world is messy, and we have the aspirational Torah Sanhedrin system, and we have the more gritty, you know, messy, real life, keeping stability, more flexible Melech system. So the fact that the king has so much more freedom to operate means that at the same time, he better not avail himself of any technical loopholes, right? You want Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira, you are not getting it, right? So at a certain sense, it is the power that the king has, right? That, as the Ran said, is exactly why he has to carry the Torah with him all day, right? Kli Chemda adds that is also the power that means that whenever relevant, he has to be holding himself to a higher standard. So, you know, if it had been some other situation, we would have said, Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira, and been a little more flexible. But once you're operating in the king paradigm, right, with great power, you know, comes a great responsibility, as someone once said. So that's you know, an idea over there. So that's these two systems. So next week, you know, we'll focus a lot on the Melech this week. Next week, we'll look at the Sanhedrin. What exactly is the Sanhedrin supposed to do? Now we kind of left the Sanhedrin, you know, like as this almost like base medrash entity. So we got to build the Sanhedrin back up and see what exactly the role of Sanhedrin is in government. So we'll look at that next week. And then we'll look at monarchy and democracy. And then we'll wrap up the unit. So if there's a question up to here. Otherwise, thanks for logging on. Good to see everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night.